two and one. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 63rd episode of Unspun. Today, Joe and I are joined by Jason Horsley, who was with us last week, as
you
well
need
as
a website. Why not
Steve
do it
Outram.
With Wix,
and I've
you can
got the volume running there on that. Sorry if that bled through. Anyway, welcome. And today I've given a working subtitle for or a working title for this episode, The History of the Normalization of Pedophilia. And there's a lot of meat to cover for this episode. Jason's research is very in-depth. I've also been wanting to cover a lot of this research with Steve and overlapping ideas and directions. So, Steve, welcome to the show as well.
Thanks, John.
And also support the show, Caesar's Messiah, my website, GnosticMedia.com. Jason Horsley, what is your website again?
Horticulture.com.
And Steve is Burners.me.
Yeah, Burners.me.
And so all of us are out there, but anyway, welcome. Also welcome the listening audience. This is a live broadcast. All right, so where should we begin this week?
Well, I mean, I thought that the conclusion last week, we really hadn't completely got through all of Jason's material.
Absolutely.
There's so much of it. But Jason, just to stay in theme, pedophilia, did you come across, because I know you have these comments on Saville. Was there anyone else that you found that is, you know, connected into the hidden world of pedophilia that the British aristocracy is seeming to engage in?
I think the main lead there is the Pedophile Information Exchange, which was the movement in the 70s, which came out of the National Council for Civil Liberties, which I mentioned last week. So that was to do with progressive leftist politics and sexual freedom and the rights of minorities and themes that are very familiar to us today with transgender and what have you. And the Pedophile Information Exchange, well, without going into all the names and dates and stuff, because that would take forever, their basic aim was to either reduce the age of consent to 4 or abolish it entirely. And their rationale was, Tom O'Carroll is one of the most famous members, but there were a bunch of members and then could be members or possibly not members kind of thing, because it was part of this larger thing, which was accepted into the mainstream. The Pedophile Information Exchange didn't make it. They tried, but they failed. Anyway, their part of their reasoning was it was the right of children to have sex with adults, just as it was the right of adults to have sex with children, and that although children might not be able to consent in the usual fashion, they could consent by signaling. So the Pedophile Information Exchange, part of their argument, well, Tom O'Carroll specifically, was that he knew how to read a child's signaling, whether it wanted to have sex or not. So he would, he would describe things that he interpreted as flirtation on the part of the child, and that this was the child communicating that it wanted to have sex.
And of course, it's always the predator who decides what signals are, the child flirting or whatever to encourage such behavior, as if a child even knows such things.
Right, exactly. So, and obviously one of the primary tenets of this drive was to completely refute the notion that having sex with children was in any way harmful. And you'll find that, you probably looked into this, Jan, with Margaret Mead, and I don't know about Gregory Bateson, but certainly Margaret Mead wrote about it in her anthropological work, like having sex with children, how it was perfectly normal in these cultures and whatnot.
Well, absolutely. Well, she studied under Bronislaw Malinowski, of course, whom we brought up last week. And then also who studied under Malinowski was Wilhelm Reich, who then published, about the sexual liberalization of children based on Malinowski's work, The Sexual Life of Savages. You know, so you know, they basically took the Trobendor Islands and said, okay, here's the sexuality of these islands as per whomever, I guess it was Malinowski was the anthropologist on the island. And then based on this one instance, all the world's sexuality needs to be this, right? So that, you know, so your children need to have the same sexuality, you know, but apparently Reich had fudged a lot of Malinowski's citations. And I have both Reich and Malinowski's books. I have not gone through and verified the citations yet. That is something that I've been meaning to get to, you know, but I've read like reviews on Amazon and other places where people have pointed out that he did indeed fake them. So I just want to go through, and if I can find, you know, a good handful that he's faked, then we absolutely know for certain that he's, you know, selling this false agenda.
Mm-hmm. So anyone else want to chip in at this point?
Well, I think that that we should make the distinction between pedophilia and what I believe is called hebephilia, which is the love for teenagers. And it seems that, you know, something that I noticed in reading your paper, Jason, was a story about, you know, wayward youth being brought into these, you know, sort of homes to look after them and rehabilitate them. And I keep coming across these like wayward youth, like I've mentioned before, Justin Brierley, who appears to have recruited Neil Cassidy and introduced them to Allen Ginsberg, letting him become part of the Beats, and also recruited the CEO of Lockheed Martin, both when they were 15-year-old troubled teens in Denver. And in many of, you know, one of the Burning Man founders was a 16, 15-year-old homeless teen with a juvenile warrant out for him when he first came across the people in the community. So, you know, I wonder if there is some sort of tie-in with these homosexual cults and their need to recruit wayward youth who they then groom to become the future members. And then that's what's behind, you know, funding all of these Rockefeller Foundation-backed studies and you know, pseudoscience like Kinsey. Is really simply a justification for their actions with a scientific veneer.
Right. Hmm. Well, there's two things going on here. I mean, there's many more, but two things that are very key. One is that you have these people with these sexual proclivities and they want to justify their behaviors and they want to implement them and create the environments that they can have sex with children or worse. There's a lot worse than just having sex with children, as everyone here knows. And then on the other hand, there's the actual program of traumatizing children and the agenda behind that. You know, like there are specific results that are being brought about through sexual traumatization of children. And so one of the things that I'm always coming up against is like you were saying, Steve, with the different definitions of what we're talking about here, they're not very clear. Like in my 20s and 30s, for example, I used to think that having sex, you know, for an adult or a 30-year-old or whatever, to have sex with a 14-year-old girl, say, there was nothing wrong with that because it was just part of nature, which of course is what they're arguing now. And so the point I'm making here is it's a very unclear area. Like, it's very hard to say exactly, you know, what's appropriate and what's inappropriate, unless you go to an extreme, like the Pedophile Information Exchange went to an extreme, and then it's pretty damn clear, even though they were trying to argue that there was no harm in that. But for most of us, it's kind of like, well, how do we actually approach this in a way that we can demonstrate that there's something wrong here without falling back on moral, you know, agenda, moral criteria? Because, you know, nature is... it does trump morality. Like, we can't impose morality onto nature. And so my answer to that is looking at the actual effects of sexual abuse of children and how that is part of the motivation of these groups and these individuals, because they know full well the harm it does. They know full well the damage it does. And it serves their purposes, both to do that and to conceal the fact that it's doing harm and to create you know, I push this agenda that, like Richard Dawkins says, no, it happened to me, I'm fine, look at me, you know, I'm Richard Dawkins. Like, you know?
But then that could be an argument against him as well, I was depending on the angle.
One thing that struck me in my research about secret societies is that, you know, a lot of them do seem to be men only, and there are definitely women only ones out there, but much, much harder to find out information about them.
Yeah.
But in these men only groups, and that includes organizations like the Jesuits and the Vatican as well, you know, you don't have this concept of primogeniture, which is the firstborn son inherits the wealth. Or daughter in some societies. And so if you look back at in the history of say, Western Europe over the last 1,000 or 2,000 years, you've got all these kings and queens and noblemen, you know, living in their big castles. And then you've got the church almost like a sales force, you know, coming in, trying to cut a deal with them. So listen, instead, you know, maybe you don't have a kid, or maybe you do, but your kid's no good. You know, when you pass away, give all your lands, et cetera, to the church. And then you've got a place assured for you in heaven. And many, many did, signed up, gave those lands away, and then there's no children. So the organization is selecting an heir. And in the secret societies, I think it's very much like that as well. It's been one of the keys to the power of groups like Skull and Bones, is that because there isn't really any blood-driven successor, I mean, as far as we know, it seems like this, you know, they can be interchangeable and replaced, and therefore, how can you ever remove this structure from the planet?
Hmm.
What are your thoughts on that, Joe, having tracked secret societies back to the tectonic?
Oh, gee, the rules would be different, I think, from one to the next, and also they would be different based on the levels, I think, that... you know, the different individuals would be in. At the very top, I don't think there are any sort of rules whatsoever. I think that basically they just assume that everything belongs to them. And if they want it, they just take it. So, you know, it would just depend on where you are. Skull and Bones, you know, I look at, like, you know, what I do is, I think most of these things are simply related to Freemasonry, and they had to create new versions of the secret society. So you get Bilderberg, you know, you get Bohemian Grove, you get Skull and Bones, but they're all related. And that's why I've always been, for so long, I've been saying we need a DNA database. The DNA database would enable us to not only know more about our politicians, but we could then cross-connect the secret societies. And so we could see, you know, that this guy who is from a Skull and Bones family is actually, you know, a relative of this guy from a Bohemian Grove family, who is a relative of this Freemason Ulster Scott family, you know, and then you'd be able then to, you know, get these question and answers specifically. You'd really know exactly, you know, who these guys are. I mean, you know, the reason that they have to do the rebranding is because if they just kept it as Freemasonry, it'd become too visible. So they have to constantly be changing, you know, new groups, new names. I mean, look at Aleister Crowley. You know, his bizarre Satanism is a new form of Freemasonry. But I'm sure that as you know, progress through Crowley's system, you'd end up under the control of a, you know, just a very generic, straightforward Freemason structure, you know? So,
Crowley, I just learned today, he was initiated into the Order of the Golden Dawn in a Masonic lodge. So, yeah. I mean, that suggests that the Order of the Golden Dawn itself was, you know, that was a Masonic order.
Yep.
Also, I noticed, Jason, in your paper discussing the Order of Chironia, there's a picture of the logo, and it's an inverted triangle. In one corner is the letter O, in the other corner is the letter C, Order Chironia, I guess. And then at the bottom of the triangle is the number 338. And that sort of made me think of 322, the Skull and Bones number. And right. It's just a pretty clear sign to me that this is just yet another Masonic lodge. And I don't know if you want to... describe what that is to the audience, or if you like me to take a crack at that.
Who, me?
Yeah, with the Order of Chironia.
No, you go ahead. I got something to say about Crowley if we get a chance, but you go ahead with that thread.
Okay, well, and then I'll tie that back to Crowley. But basically, this is a secret society of homosexuals in Britain. And homosexuals, you know, it was illegal, but they needed a way to get together, I guess. It was founded by George Cecil Ives, who's a friend of Oscar Wilde. And so Wilde was believed to be a member. Another guy believed to be a member was Montague Summers. He was an occultist and a black magician, Satanist. He was a disciple of Cecil Williamson, and Cecil Williamson was a friend of Aleister Crowley. Montague Summers was just an acquaintance. So, you know, this order of Chironia is based on the Uranian movement, and it's the concept that there's a third gender, that there are females trapped inside a man's body, and they just really want to be females, which is this transgender movement as well. So it seems like the Order of Chironia was started by followers of the Uranian movement, and it was linked to this Isis Urania Temple of the Golden Dawn, which that's where you get Samuel McGregor Mathers and Aleister Crowley, and you know many of these people who were occultists were also practicing sex magic. They were practicing homosexual acts, and they were practicing sodomy in particular, with a view towards opening up the third eye. And I think you mentioned in your paper, Jason, that you know it seems unlikely that these people who all knew each other and were all doing these same occult sex magic homosexual rituals, you know, weren't aware that each other was doing that at the very least, if not participating in each other's rituals. So hey. It seems like a very fascinating time of history around the creation of the Fabian Society. And then you get, you know, let's bring it back to Crowley.
Just a second, Steve. Your mic, your audio may be going through the wrong microphone. You may want to make sure that the mic in your face is pulling the audio. I'm not hearing it hot. Okay, or really? Tap it. Definitely not on.
Okay. What about now?
Nope. Okay. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Should we go to Crowley then?
Yeah, let's go to Crowley.
I mean, it's a really wide subject. This is reminding me of conversation I had with Lavender way back, because we talked about the whole tradition, if you can call it that, of shamans who dress as women, and that there just seems to be this thread running through occultism and shamanism of men who want to be women. It's even in Castaneda. We want to go into that, probably not, but. Anyway, as Crowley as a case study of that, I mean, he's a great. That's the reason I'm devoting so much attention to him at this point, distasteful as it is, because it's just like a microcosm of the whole movement. I think if you find a kind of a blood sample that's as infected as Crowley is, so I got a bunch of quotes here. Anyway, I'll throw them out. They won't necessarily lead to an argument or anything, but hopefully they will spark something. It's from Confessions. He writes on page 113 about pederasty in Oxford, specifically at Balliol, the college, and refers to it as the great tradition of statesmanship. He himself describes himself as a congenital masochist, Crowley. He liked to imagine himself in agony. In particular, he liked to identify himself with the beast. Well, obviously, we know that. But the fact that it's related to, you know, his magical identity as the beast is related to his masochism. He describes women as beneath contempt. Intellectually, they did not exist. And he says, he wrote, it was highly convenient that one's sexual relations should be with an animal, i.e. woman, with no consciousness beyond sex. So that was his view of women. On sodomy, he said, there's no better way to avoid the contaminations of women and masturbation, and that all great men of antiquity were sodomites. And then there's this particularly strange thing he wrote in Magical Record of the Beast, which is, my will to free mankind is, so to speak, sodomitic. And then in The World's Tragedy, he wrote, an aristocratic virtue which our middle class had better imitate if they wish to be smart, as in sodomy. Sodomy is the aristocratic virtue. And I also thought this was an interesting quote I found in Robin Bryan's book, Dust Has Never Settled. I'm not familiar with this, but John Sparrow, I don't know if anyone here knows who this is, his creed was that only practicing male homosexuals can be geniuses. So I just think there's a whole can of worms here, which of course ties into the Greek culture and the pederasty and the Greek culture and how that was all to do with grooming, you know, males towards becoming cultural leaders and whatnot. I think that we're looking at something along those lines. I can't profess to understand it because I think there's very many different angles from which to approach it. But that it is a tradition that reaches very far back and that it does in some way pertain to what's going on in our present culture, the one that we were born into and grew up into, which was the normalization of homosexuality and now transgendering and eventually apparently pedophilia. So I'll just go back to my screen if anyone wants to interject at that point.
Well, and we see this whole agenda, you know, Allen Ginsberg, and we had that clip that I think it was Steve and I that played, or was it Hans and I who played the clip of Allen Ginsberg speaking at NAMBLA, and and the, you know, Peter Lamborn Wilson and the temporary autonomous zones and Burning Man, which of course Steve Works brings together, and your work and personal history of the, you know, with your family through the Fabians and all of these organizations with your own personal history into this, and then our research coming at it from growing up, going to Grateful Dead shows and writing books on the CIA stuff, and Joe coming at this from an ancient historical perspective as well. And it just, you see these same techniques and patterns repeating over and over, the social control, the pedophilia, the, you know, connecting into things like Pizzagate, etc. All of this seems to be really at the top, you know, tier of this control structure.
Now, what was Crowley a pedophile? I noticed a good response in a comment from you, Jason, about that. You found that there's images on the wall of the Abbey in Thelema.
I'm actually putting together all the evidence for that. Although I would say at this point that I think it's a danger in simplifying these kind of things to, you know, was so-and-so a pedophile? I think, as you were kind of indicating before about the definitions, that a word like pedophile can be a red herring in a certain sense. I mean, for one thing, what we're talking about here isn't pedophilia, because pedophilia is child love. Now, that may be immoral, that may be traumatic, it may be harmful, but it's nothing compared to the torture and rape of infants. We're talking about actual sadism and torture and...
Steve, can you at least try to turn up the microphone that's on, because we're barely hearing you?
Yeah.
You don't hear this one?
No. Tap it again. Nope, we're not getting anything out of that mic at all. The other mic that you had on earlier, just turn it up more loudly so that we can hear you. Yeah, we're not getting anything. Check your Zoom setting down there in the bottom left, too, and make sure the Zoom is connected to the correct microphone.
Sorry, Jason, have you had a chance to look at the pictures that the comment describes of
Joe? Abbey?
Yeah, at Thelema Abbey.
Yeah, I haven't found any images of the Abbey. I mean, it may well be that there was artwork. But, you know, that doesn't make a very convincing case to the people who are already, you know, bored into the Crowley mythos. I'm looking for something that's a lot more persuasive. And,
sure,
as you and John have found out, it's really, with this kind of stuff, one rarely finds a smoking gun. The way to go is to just gather so much circumstantial evidence that at a certain point it becomes overwhelming. And with Crowley, that has been, it's actually been pretty easy. And some of it is remarkable by how, it's just incredible it's been overlooked, because it's so damning, it's so suggestive. And actually, as I said on my recent podcast with William Ramsey, one of the big clues or kind of red flags is the fact that this, it gets ignored. Like that there are things that Crowley has written, there are things that have been written about Crowley which are so potentially damning, and they don't get picked up by any of the other scholars. By they just, you know, they just like soap bubbles, they just appear and then they burst, and you know, it's really bizarre, and it's a pretty strong case for you know, an orchestrated effort to maintain Crowley's image as intact as it is, you know.
Right. Not that it's the best one, but they don't want it to lead to basically questioning the relationship between Crowley and the current pedophilic scandals. They're trying to partition that off.
And not to mention, what about the entire intelligence community?
Yeah, I mean, Crowley, it's amazing. And I do hope that you bring out that circumstantial evidence as a paper, because you know, you get people like Tim Leary talking about, you know, I'm just following in Crowley's footsteps. I'm basically someone who is, you know, influenced by Crowley, and that's really what where I'm taking my work. And then John Lennon talks about this, and you know, this is why we really do have to understand all we can about Crowley, because he somehow, for some reason, became, you know, just this focal point of the cult of Satan that pops up so often in the counterculture, and also with hedonism, you know, do what thou wilt. So the more we know about Crowley, the better. And when you mention that people are overlooking it deliberately, seemingly, that's really an important thought. That's a very, very important thought. And so good luck with your research. I hope to read the paper as soon as you get it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was talking to William Ramsey about it, I used the term the instrument of the aristocracy, and we talked about how Crowley, you know, he's been framed, if you will, or presented to us through the culture as a rebel, as a pioneer, you know? Yeah. But all the evidence suggests, and it isn't particularly hidden either, that he was part of the aristocracy, part of the elite, and that he was assigned this role of whatever we're going to call it, you know, introducing these values of do what thou wilt and everything that implies to the culture. And it was a kind of Trojan horse or a delivery device. And you don't have to look very deeply into occultism to see that the will to power is basically a carte blanche or a rationalization for every imaginable human depravity. And that was Crowley's philosophy. It was transgression, liberation through transgression.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think Crowley was, was created to damage culture. I mean, he's a completely artificial lifetime actor. He's as fake as, you know, Gordon Wasson. He was just created and became this public phenomena because above him, individuals wanted to introduce a very depraved, kind of theology. And you have to remember, like someone like Crowley, you know, there's not a lot of people that are close adherents of Crowley, but look at the general influence.
Yeah.
How powerful that is. Look at Marina Abramovich and spirit cooking, right? Which our elites engage in, and we saw all these celebrities and films engaging in these spirit cooking dinners that she puts on. I mean, that's all Crowley. That's just the cake of light. That's his ritual. And so, he's been very effective and has had tremendous cultural potency in terms of debasement. And so, I think that that's what you're dealing with him. I just don't see him as a sincere person. He's just weaponized anthropology, very cleverly designed, and he's just there to hurt our culture.
Yeah, Jan, how's my audio now?
Much better.
Yeah, much better.
So, where did Crowley get all this from? And you know, his parents were in this exclusive brethren. That's a cult. And I believe before that, in his ancestry, they were Quakers, and they came back to England from the UK. These Plymouth Brethren that went across and then returned. But, you know, Crowley went to Cambridge. He was at Trinity College, and John Dee went to the same college. Alan Turing, you know, another very famous homosexual, went to Trinity College. And I say famous homosexual not to dismiss any of the contributions that Alan Turing made to computing, but because I recently went to the UK, I went to a visit to Bletchley Park, where all of the great World War II cryptography was done. And the museum there is a shrine to Alan Turing and his hero-ness of the LGBT movement. There are gigantic rainbow-coloured Google signs all over Bletchley Park and big billboards about how Alan Turing was a homosexual. Now, what the hell does that have to do with cryptography? I mean, it's a clear example of how companies like Google are promoting this LGBT agenda. And Crowley, perhaps he was promoting that agenda. He seems to me have been promoting a libertine agenda. As Jay says, cultural debasement, I guess a more broad, you know, attack on humanity, attack on civilization. And certainly it looks to me like an attack from the elites against the working classes, with the destruction of the middle class, if that ever existed in the first place. That seems like the agenda. And so the unit is really part of that, of keeping the masses down so that the feudal lords can rule from their castles and, you know, justify whatever depravity they want, because there's a steady stream of people trying to rise up the ladder by indulging in it.
Yeah, I think it's a good distinction to make between an attack on humanity versus an attack on culture, and use debasing culture. Well, I mean, particularly through the work of people like Jan, and I like to think myself as well, it gets harder and harder to see anything positive about culture. Like to what extent?
It's not the culture per se. It's the, I mean, then you start sounding like a nut like Terrence McKenna working
for
the CIA.
I know. It's like, where's
that? But, you know, it's not the culture really per se. It's the overarching structure, the control system, the elite pederasty, you know, and these connections within it. And I sent you a couple of emails today that kind of possibly allude to, you know, more of these ideas we should probably go into one of these days. But, you know, the Mirana Abramovich screenshot I showed a bit ago tells a bit about it. But, you know, it's her holding this, you know, this infamous, it's her in the infamous photograph holding the faggot, the bundle of sticks and twigs, with Jimmy Comet from Comet, Pizzagate, whatever. You know, they're all making a joke about her. It's clear that it's an inside joke, and then this is leveraged into fascism. Once you understand what a fascist is, you can begin to see how one is maneuvered into the other. And so there becomes this whole underlying theme of this, you know, weaponized faggot, essentially. It's a lot to go into without the symbols and photographs. You know, I suppose I should see if I can show Abramovich's photo there again.
I wonder if, as you discovered, Jan, that Crowley was on Esopus Island and he was, you know, painting Do What Thou Will on the rocks. Was that spirit cooking, that he was inviting the nearby, you know, moguls of the Poughkeepsie Yacht Club to, you know, come across to this crazy English guy's island and do some spirit cooking?
Right. And, you know, in the Vanderbilts, they had, like, you know, to swim across a couple of hundred yards to get over there to Esopus and join Crowley's little party. You know, it's very possible. Who knows? We don't have photographs and whatnot of the history, but you have all these elite families with their mansions right on the side of the Hudson right there, and they've got their yachts, and the yacht club is right there. You know, they could have just been going straight over to the island and having little parties going on, and we're just told the official version of the story of Crowley painting this on the rocks. There was probably a whole lot more going on.
Why would Crowley pick that location? I mean,
he was an intelligence agent sent there to spy on, you know, who was coming and going.
Sure. And then you have the elite. Oh, come on. What's the name of the military academy? Right. You know, a few minutes down West Point, right down the river there. And
his orders.
I mean, you know, looking at looking off of Vanderbilt's deck, you're looking straight down onto Esopus Island, not, you know, more than several hundred yards off. I mean, you know, as straight as the bird flies, it may be, you know, 500 yards or so, but it's, you know, it's not that far. A good swimmer could swim across that in 5 minutes, I think.
Another thing about Crowley that I've looked into that I saw you touched on as well, Jason, was his relationship with Winston Churchill. That they did know each other. Some say they were friends. I haven't been able to substantiate that, but it seems that they were, at the very least, acquainted with each other. And Churchill seems to have been an occultist as well. He was in the Ancient Order of Druids, for example.
Yeah, he was heavily influenced by H.G. Wells as well, I just found out recently.
Right.
Who, of course, was Aldous Huxley's mentor.
Right.
Yeah, and a huge Freemason, right? So, you know, Wells is easy to understand. You know, his the book Wars of the World, that the
War of the Worlds, yeah.
Worlds, yeah. I mean, it's there's all of this, you know, pretty thinly veiled Freemason symbolism in it. You know, the beast in the pit coming up. This is, you know, their apocalypse, you know, symbolism. And then,
and I do recommend people check out the show that Hans and I did exposing the whole War of the Worlds thing.
Yeah, I mean, so. So, you know, when it's just this very, very sick secret society that is manipulating culture, and this the threads that we can, you know, gleam onto and like work back always lead to it. You know, you can go there from Bohemian Grove. You can go there from probably, you know, from all of the secret society.
The Grateful Dead from...
Yeah. Yeah, and the, you know,
rock, you know, all angles of rock and roll, all, you know, pornography, pedophilia, NAMBLA, all roads lead to this group.
Right.
It's amazing. MK Ultra comes out of it, you know.
Of course. And see, that's the thing, is that structure is what people, I think, really need to understand, because when you talk about MK Ultra, you know, you say, well, Huxley, there's no proof he was in MK Ultra. How can you, you know, even though he's directing the doctors.
Well, we do have his letters directing doctors
Well, here's my point. But just the fact that, you know, that MK Ultra existed shows that there's something controlling the CIA, right? You couldn't have, you know, some kind of rogue project eat up 15% of the budget of the CIA for nearly a decade. I mean, obviously, there's something that is structured above it, and that's
it's an inherent part of the organization.
And because there is this structure of the secret society, then they can control people going in or out of different projects they have. So that's why it's conceptually a very useful thing to have in your head, is that, you know, all of these things have a kind of control structure that unifies them. You know, H.G. Wells used the expression all of the different conspiracies. I don't have it in my mind, but it's
open conspiracy.
Open conspiracy that was everywhere, right? And this is really what you're dealing with is. Is just a secrecy wall behind which there is control. And on our side of it, we see, you know, glimmers of this and that, and we can make analytic threads back to it, but then we can't penetrate too deep inside the thing. We just know it's controlling all these different things. And when you see someone like Crowley, you shouldn't think that there's any more, you know, realism to his craziness than there is, for example, to Jim Morrison's dancing when he's singing the song, you know, The End. I mean, both of these things are just different aspects of culture control.
There seems to be an agenda of the secret society towards creating this new world order and this one world government. And it's kind of ironic that it's called that, because these secret societies, or the secret society, it's thousands of years old, you know, and it's been trying to create this unified planetary single government, you know, throughout history. I mean, they've succeeded and failed. It seems like they get these global empires, funded by banking, probably fiat currency. The empires, you know, get extended and too big, but nobody notices because the culture is being debased into, you know, this world of debauchery, and then it all just, you know, ends in flames, like you know, Nero fiddling while Rome burned. And you know, perhaps that's the ultimate trick, that all of this sexualization of children and everything is just to completely obsess the masses with sex, to distract them from the fact that they're being robbed blind by other bankers.
Yeah, exactly, and also being slow motion genocided.
Yeah,
as because with all
it's definitely soft kill, you know.
Yeah, they don't need to do a hard kill, which would be very difficult to do. They're just, you know, basically shaping the population to the way they want it through all of the toxicity, and I think through the vaccines. I mean, there's just, you know, no end to the mischief that they're doing in terms of culling, you know, the breeding pool, and that's why the eugenics movement, the birth control movement, the Planned Parenthood, these are such fruitful areas for research because they are related, and I think they are, you know, there is a hidden agenda in back of all of them.
Well, Bill Gates' father being one of the founders and the president of Planned Parenthood, you know, that's a bit of a red flag right there.
Unbelievable, I know.
Margaret Sanger being an open racist and then being heralded as a hero by Hillary Clinton.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it's a... Yeah, so it's a lot to take in, but it's, you know, useful for the citizen. Getting back to Crowley, did you want to finish their thought on that? Because I was
I'll comment to what everybody's been saying. It'd be easier because that's the thread I'm on right now. Like we're all here interested in looking at the big picture and mapping all that and trying to figure out where it's going. And obviously that's endlessly fascinating. But I think that could also be a red herring. And one of the things that, I said last week, I always bring it back to my own experience. And you know, I wrote a book recently, which was not ostensibly about conspiracy at all. It was about movies called Seen and Not Seen. And it was about my own adolescence specifically, you know, growing up and trying to find an identity for myself and watching movies. And also this was a period that I was discovering some very dark imagery through video nasties. I grew up in the period when the video nasties were a big thing in England, and they were being banned and they were hard to find. And I was exactly at that age, you know, 13, 14, adolescence, looking for forbidden, you know, fruits and what have you. And I got sucked into that. And without going into the gory details, because it is pretty gory and it's pretty unpleasant, but that's what the book is about largely. I latched on to this kind of torture porn. Like now it's kind of, you know, there's a word for it. Back then it wasn't, you know, I just thought there was something wrong with me that I found this imagery of violence against women arousing. I thought I was, you know, just basically damaged in some way. Point being is that I realize now, looking back at that time, this is an example of cultural infiltration. I did an enormous amount of damage to my libido that way, by actually latching onto that imagery and, you know, using it for sexual stimulation. And it's actually, I mean, okay, that was still an effect rather than the cause. If I hadn't been traumatized when I was much younger, I wouldn't have been drawn to that material, but it definitely, you know, infected the wound or whatever. It deepened the wound and deepened the pathology in me. And my point here is that if there's a way to understand all of these big picture things we're looking at, I think personally the only way for me to do it is to look at how it's affected me. And, you know, I don't run into Freemasons. I don't have any memories of being richly abused, although I'm not ruling it out. You've read my paper, so I have more than most people some sort of direct experience, but I still don't have a sense of, you know, how... of what's going on behind the scenes and what the goals are. But one thing I absolutely know from my own experience is that my own sexuality was hijacked. And I think that's my sense of a unified field theory of what's being done here through the culture is like a concerted effort to hijack and damage and distort our sexuality, because I think that sexuality is key to being in our bodies and being embodied is key to autonomy. Like, to be really autonomous as organisms, we need to be at home in our bodies and responding instinctively and intuitively to our environment, and not turning to culture or teachers or leaders to direct us. So I think that that's the main focus of the attack here, is on each of our individual sexuality, how to hijack it, how to damage it, how to wound it, how to distort it, how to create shame around it. And, you know, once that's been achieved, everything else kind of falls into place.
How do you protect yourself, or how would you suggest, like, parents with the children, protect them from the assault? Is it specific enough that you can generalize about it? In other words, you know, it's not, you know, culture to culture or country to country. I mean, do you think that the overall project has principles that can be generalized, talked about?
I think I do. I mean, I guess, again, it's like we can only really talk about our own experience there. So, and I'm not even a parent, so I'm hardly in a position to advise a parent. I mean, this came up at my website today, because I did this podcast with Ramsey about Crowley, and somebody commented, oh, something about letting children watch their parents have sex, that's child abuse. And I said, well, is it? Like, you know, with Crowley, that was the thin end of a wedge. Like, he wanted children to witness sexual magic and all the rest of it. And we know with Crowley that this was the thin end of the wedge, and that he kind of exploited the Victorian morality and moralism and the basic sense that we've had our sexuality, we've had a lot of shame created around our sexuality. He exploited that to then implement the opposite, which is shamelessness and total sexual licentiousness. Now, we all here know that doesn't work either, right? But none of us want to go back to the so-called Victorian moralism. Actually, the Victorians weren't as moralistic as we're taught.
Well, you know, I do know a lot of people beginning to wake up and getting back to family and things like that as well. So I think a lot of people really are beginning to see how damaging this has all been. And, you know, it's the family has always been their target. The communist communes of the 60s and 70s didn't work out, except for one that was funded by FEMA. And, you know, so all of this behavior didn't work out, and it promoted narrow-mindedness, closed-mindedness. You know, we all know people that are constant navel-gazers that you can't have a reasonable, logical conversation with. And we see that overall, at least from our experience, the agenda was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And the sex and drugs obviously are the physical, but the rock and roll, and I've had several conversations with Hans about this, seems to be almost the apex of the mind control system, because you can get the sex and the drugs onto a whole new level of effect when you have music involved. And then all of this using the Bible, you're using the Kabbalah to reverse engineer the Bible, I should say, to destroy society. Is that what you generally see going on as well?
Who's the you?
You as in Jason Horsley.
Okay, this is four of us here. It is. I had a brain fart there because I definitely had a response.
Can I maybe I know what it pick was. Up a little bit and bring it back to Crowley while Jason is see if he can remember the response?
I did want to say, actually, I remembered. I just want to say, and then I'll let you speak. I think one of the things we're seeing here is evidence of what Jan's talking about is the identity politics, which brings it to transgender. we're living in a world now where basically everybody wants to be able to say what they are in their own mind, and biology be damned. And anyone who questions it is a hate criminal. And so, I mean, it's so destabilizing. Like, we've lost the ground. We've just lost the ground. And so it's almost impossible to have a dialogue like we're having here. Because if you say the wrong thing, you trigger somebody, and so on, yeah, and then it snowballs, and then, yeah, so.
It's ruled by sophistry.
Yeah, the rule of sophistry, exactly.
Well, what I wanted to say about Crowley and highlighting his role as an intelligence agent is, you know, we know from MK Ultra and George Hunter White in San Francisco was doing Operation Midnight Climax, where they had these apartments hooked up with cameras and microphones. They had one in Greenwich Village, I believe there's similar stuff in London. And these beautiful women, prostitutes, would lure men back to the apartment, dose them with LSD, and then film them. And supposedly this was sort of like blackmail material. They cheated on their wife, and look how foolish this guy was on the acid or whatever. But yeah, that's absolutely fact that that happened, and that's proof that the CIA, as an example of an intelligence agency, is running these human blackmail operations on people, sex stings. This day and age, you know, in Ashley Madison, whatever, someone had sex with a prostitute in a bar, it's perhaps not as shocking as it once used to be. Right. And so that then leads into bringing children into it, underage, Jeffrey Epstein, Pedophile Island, you know, the role of intelligence agencies in recruiting young people to involve others in their schemes and plots. And Crowley may well have been trying to do something like this by being so evil and licentious or whatever. If you actually secretly went to one of his rituals or parties, that could be a smear on your reputation. So
absolutely,
that might have been a way to entrap them. And that sort of goes back to the Hellfire Clubs as well, which I believe had the same aspect to them of you know, come and do this devilishly naughty thing. Isn't a lot of fun to have an orgy? And only later do you realize that, oh, well, now you're going to be compromised because they have evidence that you did something you shouldn't have done.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of evidence that Crowley was involved in that. I've just been uncovering it. I mean, some of it's not new because some of it's in Spencer's book.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Spencer's book is great. But yeah. You know, Crowley, was he genuinely a believer in magic? I think he really, really was. You know, I think these rituals are the real deal. But you have to look at him as an agent and, you know, was he employed simply by the intelligence agencies? Well, no. If you look at what he did, it was Freemasonry and all these occult lodges, which is really the same thing. So he was an agent of the secret society, which happens to be in control of many intelligence agencies.
Is it possible, or do any of you see possibly a move away from homosexuality as their manipulation tool over to more extensively pedophilia?
I think they're pushing pedophilia and incest now, like the LGBT. You know, they got the gay marriage through. So it obviously wasn't about gay marriage, because now this agenda of incest and pedophilia is being pushed in. I say most of the gay people I know are absolutely against that. So where the hell is that coming from? It seems to be these same movements. So you know, it suggests there was something underlying it all along. But you just see all the Hollywood shows that have, you know, Game of Thrones, for example, incest storyline, like Ray Donovan, incest storyline. Like, what? Why all of a sudden do the major, major top Hollywood shows suddenly all have this incest and then pedophilia? Then I also hear that bestiality is you know, on the rise. Like, this is the absolute decline of civilization, you know?
And they're laughing all the way while they do it, you know?
Yeah, they are.
Well, hopefully we see the massive demise of the mainstream media here as quickly as possible, but the rate at which they've taken over, the intelligence community has taken over the alt media as well, it, you know, it leaves us wondering. I mean, there's a handful of shows like this out there that are left that are even going to expose any of this stuff. So what's going to happen when the MSM finally collapses?
That's a good question. It's going to collapse. The believable percentages and people, the percentage of the population that actually think that mainstream media is real is declining very rapidly. I saw a recent statistic of 33%, and you know, like 17%, something would be just the absolute zero. Basically, you can't get, because 70% of Americans believe in Bigfoot. You know, so 33% is getting pretty close to zero. And And the people who are getting information through the alt media is just is the other side of that. It's just it's skyrocketing. So
well, but you know, at the same time, the intelligence community knows that, and that's why they've co-opted so much of it. You know, from the get-go.
Absolutely, but in the transition, there is opportunity. You see, because now shows like this can actually get thousands and thousands of people that listen to it. Podcasts can exist, you know, with analysis that can basically break up a lot of the control structure that people have. I think 911 is another, you know, really tough situation for the secret society, because I know that the recent statistic I saw was over 50% of Americans don't believe the government story now.
And well, have you seen the video of Trump questioning 9/11 on the day of it? So it came up.
Yeah. So you see, it's sort of like, well, that just sits out there festering in people's minds, and it definitely is eroding confidence in mainstream media. So, I mean, of course, they are just very energetic to try to, you know, get their puppets in positions of, you know, dominance in the alt media, but it's tough. I think there's a lot of people coming forward with authentic attempts to analyze history and analyze our culture. And, you know, there's just something about telling the truth. people can kind of tell when they have a sense about that. I think that, you know, as people become skeptical and they go into the alt media, I just think that now that there's so many people who are, you know, authentic researchers that are trying to talk about these problems in the media, that there's just, it's just going to grow. In fact, I was talking on a show a few days ago, and I was saying, you know, the trajectories are really heading for a collision, because I don't think you can get 3 or 4 million people in a country like America that are absolutely clear on what the you know, the secret societies of its existence and how it controls things, because that is just too large of a number, you know. And yet I think we're going to get there within a year, and then what are they going to do?
Well, they're going to put Beyonce and Katy Perry on the Super Bowl going,
they're going to try. Good luck. Good luck to them. I think that...
They get exposed as well at the same time.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. So I just... I don't know. These are interesting times, my friends. We're going to see. But I think it's our responsibility to just push as hard as we can over the next year, couple years, because this is the time when there's a chance, you know, that all of this control that these guys have been building up over our minds, you know, for hundreds of years, we have a chance to expose it.
Does anyone here wonder if that maybe... I was going to say a coming out party would not be the right way to put it, but if our handlers or our social engineers are confident enough at this point to feel that they can pretty much expose their designs, because there's nothing anyone's really going to do about it. I mean, and when I say do, I don't know what that means, whether they're afraid of an uprising or whether it's just to do with, you know, an internal...
At the same time, they do seem to be very afraid of this show getting viral. I mean, we see them messing with view counts. Steve and I watched them rolling back our numbers, filing false copyright claims to have videos removed, all kinds of stuff. So, you know, they're definitely anxious about this stuff. I mean, if you think like 10,000 people watch Steve's and my series, that could easily infect the whole Burning Man community in 1 or 2 years.
Of course, there's different agendas, aren't there? I mean, there's financial, and then there's different levels of power. But I can certainly see that, I mean, social engineering is definitely about controlling the flow of information, perception management, all the rest of it. So they would have to regulate, you know, a show like yours or not, whatever it is, you know, just all the different variables, because they see a spike there. They know there's going to be a corresponding reaction over there. So, okay. We've got,
yeah. Just so you know, we have about a minute left here.
It's going to be tough for them to control.
Yeah, Steve, did you have something to add there, Steve?
Just on the YouTube, you know, view counts being manipulated. I think more and more people are waking up to that this is going on, and that this is being applied to all kinds of videos, Facebook as well. The tech companies, they seem to be coming out and saying, okay, yeah, Facebook, Reddit, Twitter, Google, yeah, you know, we censor the news feed, we tailor it to each individual, sorry. But that's it. That by saying that they do it, well, everyone keeps using it, so they got away with it. Done. There goes all of our freedom and privacy.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Anything left to add? We have a few seconds left. Did you want to give out your website again there, Jason?
Yeah, it's audiculture.com/limitless. The podcast with William Ramsey this week probably will be interesting to your listeners.
And Steve?
Burners.me, burners.me.
Joe?
Caesarsmessiah.com. And listen, I want to thank Steve and Jason. It's just absolutely wonderful to be in an exchange with you guys. I really do appreciate
likewise,
it.
Thanks, Joe.
Awesome. Likewise. Awesome talk. I appreciate it. Next week, I think we'll be having April Bowden on to be discussing vaccines. That should be a great show. So take care, everyone, and good night, and see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.